The number of positive coronavirus cases surrounding President Trump continues to grow, but contact tracing efforts have been limited.
My colleague and I started reaching out to folks in some of the states that the president traveled to immediately before he announced that he had contracted COVID-19. And as of yesterday, I was still receiving messages from officials in some of those states saying that they had not heard from the White House.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, October 6, how the White House is dealing with the fallout from a pandemic inside the office. Plus, at last week's debate, the president claimed he's made the price of insulin so cheap it's, quote, like water, but it can still cost hundreds of dollars for many Americans.
We in America pay so much more than other countries, mostly because we don't use the kinds of tools that they use to bring down the prices of prescription drugs.
And Florida is a key state for this election, and we're talking about efforts to make sure formerly incarcerated people have the chance to cast their ballots. But first, President Trump has been discharged from the Walter Reed Medical Center and is back in the White House. But positive COVID-19 cases continue to be reported for people who work in and around the Trump administration. More than a dozen people have tested positive so far, including two members of the White House housekeeping staff, as well as White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany. The president's personal physician, Dr. Sean Conley, said that efforts are being made to reach out to people who may have come into contact with the president and his associates while they were positive for COVID-19. That's a process known as contact tracing.
The White House Medical Unit, in conjunction with in collaboration with CDC and local state and health departments, are conducting all contact tracing per CDC guidelines.
But officials in many of the states and counties that President Trump visited in the days before announcing he had contracted the coronavirus say they've heard little or nothing from the federal government. And the New York Times reported yesterday that the White House is not conducting contact tracing for the Rose Garden ceremony that took place 10 days ago in honor of Judge Amy Coney Barrett. 8 people who attended that event have since tested positive for COVID-19, including President Trump. Comparing the White House's apparent lack of contact tracing to broader contact tracing efforts nationwide is where we're going to start today. Joining me now is Lisandra Villa, a staff writer for Time Magazine. Lisandra, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. Happy Tuesday.
Also with us is Amy Fairchild, dean and professor at The Ohio State University's College of Public Health. Amy, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Lisa, let's start to dig a little bit into the contact tracing efforts that the White House is doing, at least. Dr. Sean Conley said they would be doing contact tracing. You've been reaching out to officials in some of these states who said they haven't heard from the White House. Where does that stand?
That's right. My colleague Abby and I started reaching out to folks in some of the states that the president traveled to immediately before he announced that he had contracted COVID-19. And it's been, as of yesterday, I was still receiving messages from officials in some of those states saying that they had not heard from the White House. I know that New Jersey has gotten a list of names and emails for some of the people who attended a fundraiser there, but that the New Jersey government was basically saying that it wasn't enough to do a full contact tracing. And I know that the governor there was saying that they needed more from the federal side of it.
Amy, remind us, how should the White House be handling contact tracing right now?
Contact tracing is actually a rather complex jurisdictional undertaking, because as you move from one county to the next, a different set of health officials have responsibility for cases that live in that county. So it's not surprising that this is a hard problem to wrangle, given that you have a president who's traveling to different places, people coming together from across different health jurisdictions. So the way it typically works is you get a case record that's entered that's got all of that person's contacts, and then those get funneled out to the right state or county health department. Depending on which state you're in, it could be a state, it could be a county, it could be a city that's responsible for doing contact tracing in those cases.
And by your estimation, I mean, what you're hearing about the types of contact tracing that are coming out of the White House, are they sufficient right now?
Well, the White House alone is not going to be able to do it because of the way that the disease surveillance system is set up in the United States, where cases are reported at a local level, which has responsibility for contact tracing. So the White House can certainly help by making sure that names get to those locales, but it's also a question of making sure that somebody actually had contact with the president or somebody on the president's staff. Simply being in the room with somebody doesn't necessarily amount to an exposure.
What are you hearing as far as that issue? I mean, do we have a sense whether most of the campaign events that the president participated in were indoors or outdoors? The Rose Garden event was outdoors, but famously, the president and others were not wearing masks, and that we indicated that 8 people there, including the president, were infected with COVID-19. Where are the concerns here? Because if you're an outdoor event, that's supposed to be less of a risk, and yet 8 people contracted COVID.
Well, we don't know that they contracted COVID during the time in that outdoor space. We don't know what kind of contact happened before, whether people were wearing masks or not. But certainly masks are quite an effective means of preventing spread of the virus. But if you look at the CDC's guidelines, in fact, it's really 15 minutes within 6 feet of somebody, regardless of whether they are wearing masks, regardless of whether they are indoors or outdoors. So it's really the masks plus social distancing. And we don't know that people were infected in that outdoor space. The web of contacts and who was contacted when, and that can be quite complex.
I just want to push back a little bit on that, because I hear what you're saying, but at the same time, there were 8 people who were contacted in an event where people were not wearing masks. I would imagine that, including the president, that it would be, I don't know how we can't point that event to being a spreader event.
Well, it could be a spreader event, but we don't know what happened before and after that outdoor interaction. It could have happened outdoors. It could have happened indoors before or after.
Sorry, Lisa, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, what do we know about where the president was and wasn't, outdoors or indoors? The president does not comply with mask mandates. And the president, in fact, yesterday came out and removed his mask very, very for a lot of public display. So, Amy, what's the reporting say on where he was and how many of these events are indoors or outdoors?
Immediately after the president announced that he had COVID-19, I went through the pool reports and reconstructed where he'd been in the days preceding that. And there is a lot of detail in those reports about a lot of people that he comes in contact with in the course of his daily activity. And you're right that not everyone has come into contact with him for 15 or more minutes. But you do have to keep in mind the amount of movement that the president goes through. So, for example, the motorcades and who is traveling with him when he's on Marine One and on Air Force One, and who's greeting him at the bottom of the stairs, and how much time did that amount to? So there was a mix of activity, right? There's the outdoor rally, and then there's some indoor events that we have a little bit less insight to. So, for example, I know that in Hennepin County in Shorewood, Minnesota, where he attended a fundraiser at the private residence of a GOP donor, the county was waiting for a list of the people. Last I heard from them, they were waiting for a list of the people who had attended because they weren't sure how many people were actually Hennepin County residents, which goes to Professor Fairchild's point, right, about the jurisdiction on this, where they weren't sure who were they were responsible for contact tracing for. There was just a lot of activity, a lot of movement, and based on what we can glean from the public health officials that we've reached out to on the county and state levels for the places that he traveled, there's not been a ton of outreach.
Amy, when we think about contact tracing more broadly, how well are states and counties doing conducting contact tracing at the moment?
I think most states and counties, unless they have really staffed up, for instance, like Massachusetts, which has about 15 contact tracers per 100,000 population, they're getting behind in contact tracing. It can take a couple of days to a couple of weeks to reach out. And that's because it's a time-intensive interaction between a contact tracer or a disease investigation specialist and a case or a contact.
And in terms of the efficacy of contact tracing, I mean, it feels as though people need to be willing to open up and say who they've been in contact with in order for this to work. How effective have some of these contact tracing efforts been?
Contact tracing can be quite effective if there is trust in the system, if people are willing to give the names of their close contacts. But it is a challenge in that giving that contact name means that somebody is going to be quarantined for 14 days. And that can be a significant burden on people. So that's why we as a society have to really celebrate the people who participate in contact tracing, who are willing to go into isolation for 10 days, who are willing to go into quarantine for 14 days, because that's the way. It's not even so much testing our way out of it that we're aiming for. We're trying to isolate and quarantine our way, at least our way through, if not out of COVID-19.
So let's talk a little bit about that, because the president himself has not quarantined for the 14-day period. In fact, he was at Walter Reed Medical Center. He's made light of how the severity of the coronavirus, and he, in fact, took a ride in front of Walter Reed with other people in a vehicle with him. So what is that, Amy, what is that message telling the American people? And Lisa, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that as well.
Well, first, he's infected. He was infected. So that's a 10-day period of isolation. And typically, it ends on day 10.
Which I don't believe he underwent, is what I'm saying.
Well, so that it depends on when his doctors identified his first day of infection. And I do think you're right. That's unclear. It's unclear if it's
been— Oh, I know
it's
unclear. We know that the president has not been isolated for 10 days.
And that would be best practice.
But what message is that sending to the American public? Lisa, I'd love to hear your thoughts as well.
So one of the first thoughts that I had when he was leaving is the people that have to be around him still, right? Think of from Sunday when he left Walter Reed for the temporary outing and the risk that created for his security detail that was completely unnecessary, to now the risk that he's creating for the White House resident staff. So I know there was at least one Senator, Brian Schatz, who sent Chief of Staff Mark Meadows a letter on contact tracing saying that in particular he was concerned about the White House resident staff and whether they were going through the necessary contact tracing. But now that White House staff is going to have to be in the president's vicinity, right? So it's concerning when there is a president who we know has COVID, who's coming out without a mask and acting as though it's unnecessary that he take the precautions. There's major concern from people that this is going to lead to a relaxation, people taking COVID cases more casually, right, and going about their daily lives. And that's just not what we have been told from public health officials is the guidance that we should be following. So why should the president be acting any differently than what millions of Americans have been told to do to try to get past this pandemic?
Amy, and I want to get your thoughts on that, because so far we've seen 210,000 Americans die as a result of different pieces of information coming out of the White House and other governors across and states across the country. And so this feels like an inappropriate time, at least for the president of the United States, to not underscore the severity of this situation, particularly as we go into the fall and winter months.
I worry about sending the message that feeling better is equivalent to being better. And we have seen this around the country in many different cases. Somebody who tests positive, they feel fine, they think it's fine, and they end up exposing a lot of people, not appreciating the degree to which we can spread the disease even during asymptomatic periods.
Amy Fairchild is a dean and professor at the Ohio State University's College of Public Health, and Lisandra Villa is a staff writer for Time Magazine. Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you.
Florida has extended the voter registration deadline until 7 p.m. tonight after the system experienced difficulties handling the high volume of traffic to the site. And one of the looming questions has been how many former felons in the state would be able to register to vote and cast their ballots this November. Floridians overwhelmingly voted in favor of restoring voting rights to the state's formerly incarcerated population 2 years ago. But Republican lawmakers have added an additional hurdle by implementing laws that require former felons to pay outstanding court fees and fines before they can vote. And many activists have called this a modern-day poll tax. But a recent flood of donations and fundraising from people like Michael Bloomberg, LeBron James, John Legend, and Ariana Grande have poured into the state in an effort to get as many former felons registered to vote and help pay some of those debts. For more on this, I'm joined by Patricia Mazzei, Miami Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Patricia, glad to have you with me.
Hi, Tanzina. Thank you.
Do we know how many formerly incarcerated people have already registered to vote?
We don't. We know that as of May, 85,000 applications had come to the Department of State's Division of Elections and had not yet been processed, but we do not have an update on how many of those have gone through the system, nor how many people have successfully applied since then.
And we know, as we mentioned at the top, that part of this, there's one thing of getting people registered to vote. There's another thing about those who are registered to vote who can actually pay off their fees and fines and associated debts that come with their former incarceration in order to get there. So what's the process, Patricia, for getting people past that to pay off those debts? Is there a lot of red tape?
It's been very challenging for former felons, because there is no uniform system in the state to even find out how much money somebody owes. And in some cases, people had records in various counties, and they have to go county by county to find out, you know, some of this debt is very old, to find out how much they owe, and in some cases, which collection agency owns the debt now. So there are many steps to doing this. And of course, the first step is finding out how much you owe. The second is trying to get enough money to pay it off, which is where all those donations come in.
And are people still confused about whether they can vote or what the process is to get them to vote? And we're specifically talking about formerly incarcerated folks here.
Yes. Yeah, so you remember that in 2018, 65% of Florida voters passed this amendment. But the hard work basically started then for canvassers to go out and let former felons know they were even eligible. It's not like the state sent out a letter to all these folks to let them know that this amendment had passed. So I actually joined some canvassers last week, and they go to neighborhoods where they know that there is a high felon population and knock on doors and ask, are you a felon? Do you know anybody who is a felon? And in many cases, people just remember being told in court or in prison that they lost their rights to vote, and they do not know that they might be eligible, even if they have no outstanding court fines and fees. I mean, there is an estimate that some 250,000 felons don't owe anything to the courts. They could have been eligible any time after Amendment 4 went into effect, and they still don't know that they had the opportunity to go vote again.
250,000 people, that's a lot of people. We heard at the top, Patricia, that there are some big names, including former presidential candidate and former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, LeBron James, and others have spent, have funneled millions of dollars into voter registration efforts in the state of Florida. How has that money been used so far?
The Florida Rights Restoration Coalition is raising this money. They are the people who championed this amendment and put it on the ballot. And they have been trying to find felons and let them know that the money is available. They say they've had 88,000 donations. They're trying to get up to $25 million. They say they have about $20 million. And each payment to each applicant is about $1,000, according to the coalition. So the $25 million they're hoping to raise could help 25,000 people, which is not a lot when you consider that the estimates run from 1 million to 1.4 million former felons in Florida. But this is a state where very small margins tend to decide elections. So they think that helping any of these folks pay back their court fines and fees and then urging them to register and finally to actually vote would be potentially a real change for the Florida electorate.
So once again, these funds are largely being used to help people pay off those fees and fines, the outstanding debt that they have, so they can then get to the polls and cast their ballot, right?
That's correct. The folks getting this money are not obligated to either register to vote or to vote, but just they're trying to get help get them to that point where they are actually eligible to overcome that hurdle imposed by the legislature last week that you talked about.
So how have Republican officials in the state responded to that this effort? Because that really flies in the face of what they've decided.
Well, the state's attorney general, Ashley Moody, who is a Republican elected statewide, she has called for an investigation by the FBI and the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. She has suggested, as have some other Republican members of Congress, that this is some sort of inducement, illegal inducement to vote to raise all this money for the former felons. But what lawyers have told us, including academics, is that because the money is to pay off fines and fees, which is money that goes to the state and not actually for any sort of vote, you know, exchange, that they don't believe that there is a problem here. And we do not know, we should say, if the FBI or the FDLE have actually taken up the attorney general on her suggestion.
I'm sorry, Patricia, we've got about a little over a minute to go. And I just want to understand here. It seems like the Florida legislature generally is spending a lot of time and money and effort and now in trying to involve the FBI in really preventing this group of people from getting to the polls, despite what Floridians, 65% of Floridians decided 2 years ago, that this population should be allowed to vote. Why is the Florida legislature so intent on focusing so much effort on preventing this community from casting their ballot?
What they say is that the amendment to the state constitution required the fulfillment of a person's entire sentence, and that a sentence is not just limited to time in prison and parole, but also anything that they owe the courts. And what their critics say is that they worry that this felon population will lean Democratic and that this is the biggest presidential battleground state in the nation. And they're concerned that the balance might tilt towards the Democrats. We don't actually have studies that show what leanings felons have. We know that they just tend to follow what most other Floridians do, which is that there is an increased tendency to register without political party affiliation. But that is where
the
crux
of
the tension is.
Patricia Mazet is Miami Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Patricia, thanks for your reporting.
Thank you.
I'm Helga Davis, and my show is all about the art of fearless conversation.
The wonder of dialogue is that what you think is so obvious gets really questioned at a deep level.
Sometimes the truth is having those uncomfortable discussions that get to facts that we usually don't want to talk about.
Join me for a new season of Helga, wherever you get podcasts.
Over the past month, we've been tracking how the courts and the U.S. legal system have been impacted by COVID-19. It's our series called Justice Delayed, and today we turn to civil courts. Around the country, many civil court cases have been placed on the back burner or even completely ignored. And some of the biggest challenges advocates and attorneys are flagging come with housing cases. As eviction moratoriums begin to expire across the country, millions of Americans are at risk of being evicted from their homes, and the process of fighting evictions in civil court has been upended by the pandemic. Joining me now is Judge Fern Fisher, former administrative judge in charge of New York City trial courts and a member of the leadership team of the Self-Represented Litigation Network. Judge Fisher, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
What has the pandemic meant for how civil cases are being handled right now?
Well, as you just mentioned, in most states, courts came to a screeching halt, which means there were no filings and there were no processing of cases. So basically, many cases are just back burner. They're just sitting there waiting for this pandemic to subside.
And Judge Fisher, there's something called mediation. Are we seeing more mediation instead of actual trials when it comes to civil cases?
I think it would depend on the jurisdiction. Some courts don't use mediation at all. I would say that many courts are trying to settle cases through what is usually called conferencing, which means the judge or the judge's law clerk talks to the parties about trying to resolve the case. In New York, that is what's going on right now.
Judge Fischer, I've spoken to a couple of attorneys, one in particular who said, to be honest, you know, now is probably not a good time to bring a civil case because judges are also not feeling too great about having to handle these on video or Zoom or other non-traditional methods. Are you sensing that, a sense of a fatigue or even annoyance on the part of judges who are dealing with this new reality?
I wouldn't say annoyance. I think probably just stress. Many courts just didn't have the infrastructure to stop on a dime and pick up technology as a mechanism for resolving cases. And so in some cases, judges had to be taught how to use the computers, you know, how to use the Zoom or Skype or whatever mechanism that they are, you know, have to use. And, you know, it's not easy for some judges who just are not tech savvy to switch to the new norm.
Judge Fischer, what gets lost in the, I guess, video world now, or the way that these cases are being handled? What gets lost when these cases, civil cases in particular, aren't handled in person?
Let me point out that low-income and moderate-income people have always struggled with access to justice issues before COVID. So post-COVID or during COVID, the problem is that some people don't have the adequate access to the technology. They don't have laptops, they don't have iPads, so they're trying to talk to the court by a smartphone or by telephone. They have limited data, so that's a challenge. You know, the other challenge is how good technology is. If you're fading in and out, or, you know, the signal drops, that's a problem.
Judge Fischer, some of our producers who were talking to attorneys and advocates learned that one of the biggest issues here is housing court. We know that many of the housing eviction moratoriums that were put in place at the peak of the coronavirus pandemic in different jurisdictions are beginning to run out. And so how are we seeing housing related cases right now? Is there with so many people who could potentially be at risk for eviction?
You know, and again, it depends on the jurisdiction as to whether or not there is a moratorium or not. Some communities will be affected more. Statistics show that brown and black communities are affected more by eviction and also have been affected more by the economic downfall of the pandemic. So you'll see more evictions in those communities, you know, people of low income. But I think we're going to see evictions right into the moderate income or the formerly moderate income individuals. My concern is that the courts are so inundated with backlog cases that what we'll have is, you know, 30-second justice because, you know, the courts will be trying to clear their dockets.
And that hurts a lot of people, doesn't it?
It hurts both the tenant and the landlord. You know, this is mainly a tenant issue in terms of eviction, but it does affect small owners who don't, you know, really own a lot of property. So if you have one property and the tenant isn't paying rent, you can end up in foreclosure as the owner. So it really is on both sides, but it's also a community story because as people get evicted and places are empty, you know, communities are affected.
What about the ability? We talked a little bit about technology limitations here, but what about the ability for people to find representation right now because of the pandemic?
Well, representation has always been a problem for low-income people and, you know, right into the moderate income. You know, about 20% of the need of low-income people are met with respect to attorneys. A lot of legal services, legal aid programs are struggling to stay open because of the pandemic. And places where the numbers are high, they're probably still closed and operating by video. And that is difficult. So if we're talking about 80% of the population before COVID didn't have attorneys, with the numbers of people who are unemployed or who have no income, that number is going to go higher. So most people aren't going to have attorneys to fight these evictions.
And Judge Fischer, let's remind our listeners what types of cases are handled in civil court. We're highlighting housing cases because of the looming eviction moratoriums that are starting to happen across the country. But what other types of cases are we seeing that are getting held up in civil court?
Pretty much all civil cases. But, you know, the cases that affect people the most are family cases, child support, child custody, divorces, consumer debt cases aren't being heard, including also personal injury cases. So if you are someone who's been injured, you will be waiting longer to receive some kind of an award from a personal injury case. You know, there are loads of different kinds of civil cases, but the bread and butter cases are housing, family, consumer debt. Those are the cases that affect the everyday people.
And of course, we'll get more into family court issues in another segment here, but that probably means that child support issues are not being resolved. Children may be going without the necessary funds. Child custody issues are still up in the air, right?
Exactly. And so even in the jurisdictions that are beginning to hear the cases, there is a backlog. And so, you know, families will be affected by this slowdown in the courts. The courts are doing the best they can. And on top of the COVID, many courts are experiencing court budget cuts because of the lack of income of various states. For example, in New York, the New York courts are about to be cut $300 million. The court budget is over $2 billion, but when we had a $170 million cut, you know, years ago, we had to lay off 1,500 people. So, you know, double that. The court budgets mainly are personnel. So in New York, the budget is 90% people. So if you have to cut $300 million, that means court employees will be cut, and that means services to the public will be limited.
And those who choose to represent themselves, Judge Fisher, are they in a better position or a worse position given how the court is changing right now?
They were already in a precarious position. Now they're almost off the cliff. It's you know, there's going to be lack of attorneys. The court systems are going to be rushed. They are challenged with technology. The court system is already complicated for people who don't have lawyers. It's more complicated when you're trying to do things by technology.
Judge Fern Fisher is a former administrative judge in charge of New York City trial courts and a member on the leadership team of the Self-Represented Litigation Network. Judge Fisher, thank you so much.
Thank you.
At last week's chaotic presidential debate, there was one moment that flew a bit under the radar: President Trump's repeated claims about lowering prescription drug prices. Here's the president talking about the price of insulin at the debate.
I'm getting it for so cheap. It's like water, you want to know the truth. So cheap.
But that's not the truth. For many people with diabetes, insulin still costs hundreds of dollars a vial, with some patients needing two or three vials a month. And this isn't the first time Trump has claimed he's lowered prescription drug prices for Americans. In fact, it's become a major talking point on the campaign trail, though it's unclear how much effect any of his policy changes has had on the high cost of prescription drugs. And that's according to Rachel Sachs, an associate professor of law at Washington University in St. Louis.
Today, too many Americans have difficulty affording their prescription drugs. A survey that was taken in 2019, so this is before the pandemic, found that a full 24% of Americans had difficulty affording their medications. And that figure might have even gone up today, as many Americans lose their health insurance.
So why are these drugs so expensive compared to other places of the world?
So different drugs have high prices for different reasons, but we in America pay so much more than other countries, mostly because we don't use the kinds of tools that they use to bring down the prices of prescription drugs. We don't negotiate for the prices of our drugs at the federal level. We don't use tools like international reference pricing or health technology assessment to bring down those prices. So we pay more than other countries for the same product.
Now, when we're talking about drug prices, are we talking about specialized drugs or just any drug, generic drugs? What kind of drugs are we talking about?
We're mostly talking about branded drugs. Actually, the prices that we pay for generic drugs are often lower than the prices that are paid in other countries. But the problems that patients have affording their drugs here are mostly these high-cost drugs, whether they're specialty drugs or whether they're non-specialty drugs but are still protected by patents or other exclusivities.
Would that explain why there aren't more generic versions of some of these more expensive drugs?
For some of the drugs, it's about their patent protection, but for others, it may be about FDA exclusivity periods or trade secrets that make it difficult to copy these products. Different drugs have high prices for different reasons, but they all have the potential to harm patient access.
You mentioned, and we've reported on this show, that the pandemic has forced many people out of work. And as a result, many of those folks have lost their insurance. Have you seen an increase in people's inability to afford their medication since the pandemic began?
So I think it's too early to say for sure. We're hopeful that people who lose their employer-sponsored insurance might be able to qualify for Medicaid, but unfortunately, too many states have declined to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. So patients or people in Texas or Florida or other very populous states, which may have lost their employer-sponsored insurance, may be unlikely to qualify for Medicaid, which could help them afford those products, while patients in other states might be able to afford their products with Medicaid's help. It's hard to say.
What happens when someone cannot afford a drug? Do they stop taking it altogether? Are people dying?
So patients use different strategies to cope when they have difficulty affording their prescription drugs. Sometimes they refuse to fill the prescription at all. Sometimes they spread out their doses or take half of a dose at one time and half of a dose at another time. And in general, these really do have the potential to cause problems. And we've seen reports, particularly of patients who are diabetic and need insulin, that patients can die from rationing their medications.
In the first debate with Democratic candidate Joe Biden, President Trump said that he'd lowered the prescription drug prices to the point where insulin is, quote, like water. Is there any truth to those claims?
No, certainly not yet. So the president has put out a series of executive orders or plans to lower prescription drug prices, but few, if any, of them have gone into effect yet. And many Americans still have real trouble affording their prescription drugs, including insulin.
The president also said that he had put in a number of recent executive orders regarding prescription drug prices this summer. This is something that he's tried to make an issue for, at least a positive issue for his administration. Have any of those executive orders had any actual effect on high drug prices?
No, not yet. So executive orders in healthcare in general and in prescription drugs more specifically, they don't do anything on their own. They require policymaking and rulemaking to actually go into effect. And on several of the executive orders, the president and HHS have taken no public action at all. And on some of them, although they have taken public action, those policies won't go into effect before the election, if not in the months afterwards.
Medicare is the biggest purchaser of prescription drugs in the United States. So why doesn't it negotiate drug prices?
When Medicare Part D was created, Congress explicitly included in the law a provision that prevented the federal government itself from negotiating for the price of prescription drugs. Now, importantly, that doesn't mean that Medicare Part D plans, which are typically run by private contractors, can't negotiate. They do. But they're not negotiating on behalf of the federal government with its full purchasing power. And the federal government is also limited by the requirement that Medicare cover most, or in some cases, all prescription drugs within a category. So there are limitations on the federal government's ability to negotiate and to use the kind of market-based sticks that other countries or other kinds of insurers use to lower the cost of prescription drugs.
What about in Congress, Rachel? Is there any movement there in terms of legislation to lower drug prices, given, as you just said, that the president's executive orders have had little to no actual effect on the cost of prescription drug prices so far?
So in December of last year, the House passed a bill, H.R. 3, which would have done three main things and completely restructured the way in which we pay for prescription drugs in this country. So first, and perhaps most importantly, it would have allowed Medicare to negotiate for the prices of prescription drugs and helped peg what Medicare pays to the prices that are paid abroad in a range of comparable countries. Second, it would have discouraged companies from raising the prices of their drugs faster than inflation, as many companies do today by imposing penalties and rebate requirements on companies that do. And then third, it would have reformed the way the Medicare Part D benefit works so that seniors would pay a lot less out of pocket for their prescription drugs than many of them do today.
We heard a little bit about how President Trump is trying to continue this as an issue before his own diagnosis with COVID-19 at the presidential debate. But how are each of the candidates talking about what they would do to lower drug prices?
So the rhetoric between President Trump and former Vice President Biden are actually quite similar. So both of the candidates profess to want to allow drug price negotiation or to limit drug launch prices through the use of international reference pricing to make it easier for people to afford their prescription medications. I think the problem is that the president has spent several years delaying on these plans, and we haven't yet seen their impact. In fact, the president threatened to veto the Democrats' bill as they passed it in December, which would have accomplished several of these allegedly shared goals. So it's hard to see whether the president is truly committed to some of these policies.
There is a coronavirus vaccine or multiple coronavirus vaccines in the works right now. Do we have any sense, Rachel, if that is finally available to the American public, if there will be similar issues with accessing that vaccine, or will it be treated more like the flu vaccine where people can get it at work, they can potentially afford it, even if they don't have insurance, they can go to a pharmacy, for example, and get it?
Federal coronavirus legislation has attempted to make sure that the vaccine itself will be free at the point of care for all Americans. Right now, there are questions about whether the administration of the vaccine will also be available for free, but there are at least attempts on the federal level to make sure that people can afford this vaccine because we want to make sure that everyone can access it.
There are still many Americans grappling with how to afford their medication. You know, I find interesting that occasionally you'll hear television ads that say, if you're having trouble or you can't afford your medication, contact us and we may be able to help. I'm not sure how much help the pharmaceutical companies will actually provide to people who are struggling to afford medications they need to survive. But Rachel, are there places that people can turn if they cannot afford life-saving medication?
There are, but it depends on the patient and their situation. So the patient may be able to obtain access through certain kinds of health centers or clinics that will enable them to receive these medications for free. They may be able to use pharmaceutical companies' patient assistance programs for particular kinds of products. There are services like GoodRx, which enable patients to comparison shop. And in general, there are still real barriers for a lot of patients, but there are ways that some patients can get around these affordability difficulties.
Rachel Sachs is an associate professor of law at Washington University in St. Louis. Rachel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And according to some of you, the cost of medication hasn't improved since the pandemic started earlier this year.
My name is Pat, and I'm calling from Philadelphia. My one prescription for Synthroid doubled last January, and my insulin for type 1 diabetes is prohibitively high. Healthcare costs are one of my top priorities, and I don't qualify for the Affordable Care Act. And I don't have any insurance through my employer. So my family pays almost $24,000 for the four of us, plus very high copays, and we pay for prescriptions.
Both presidential candidates have put forward plans to lower these costs, but that doesn't mean those plans will change how people will vote in November.
My name's Chris from Pittsburgh. My drug costs went up about 25% since the start of the pandemic, and frankly, I don't care. Donald Trump has to go, and there's nothing that's going to sway my vote at this point.
Hi, my name is Pat, and I'm from Ramona, Kansas. I don't take a lot of drugs, luckily, but one that I find that's really necessary is called Symbicort. It's a steroid inhaler, and I take it for asthma, and that's gone up by about $50 in the last few months. There's a lot more important things at stake than the price of my medication. What's important, in as far as I'm concerned, is preserving our democracy. And so that decides how I'll vote.
Some of you have been lucky enough to avoid any major shifts in what you're spending on prescription drugs, at least right now.
This is Lori from Edwardsville, Illinois. I'd like to say no, we don't have to pay any more for our prescription. We're very lucky and have excellent insurance, though the costs and deductibles have skyrocketed since the ACA and the insurance company is taking advantage of the system. I want to be crystal clear that there's absolutely nothing that Trump could do to cause me to vote for him.
Hi, this is Tom from Glendale. I've had no increase in drug costs. I'm on Medicare, though every year there's a reevaluation of the formulary, and this doesn't affect my vote. I'm a Biden-Harris supporter, so nothing that anybody does is going to make me consider anything but voting for the most qualified man and woman to be president and vice president.
Throughout listeners' responses, a common theme emerged. The current system does not work for people, and serious changes are needed in the nation's capital.
My name is Wayne. I'm calling from the city of Fairfield. I work in healthcare, and I see people struggle every day to pay for their medications, to get treatment, and we live in a society that equates healthcare being provided for people to socialism, which is insane. In fact, what we are seeing is a society where there is socialism being practiced in the form of wealth care, where wealthy individuals and corporations get tax breaks in return for making massive donations to people for president. The problem with that is it undermines the fabric of our society, and that includes the ability to get health care, which should be a basic human right.
I'm Cheryl, calling from Jacksonville. The idea of medications being reasonable and taking big pharma out of the picture or limiting their power is exciting to me. I think that we spend way too much on medications. I'm in the healthcare field, and I think price gouging has been happening here for a long time. This will improve insurance costs, and it will improve or decrease costs to the individual patient.
All right, everybody, that's another show in the books. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. I'll be out tomorrow going to the dentist. Bridget Bergen from WNYC will be with you, and you're in good hands. And, of course, we love hearing from you, so keep calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or you can tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and I'll see you soon.